while we've been focused on net zero and the just transition and decarbonization, and I think that's been the right focus, we also want to acknowledge that the data is telling us that that 1.5 degree aspiration aligned to net zero is really escaping us. Where we can see data from the World Meteorological Association telling us we've already surpassed that 1.5 degrees and we may be on a well over 2 degree trajectory.
Welcome to The Greener Way. I'm your host, Michelle Baltazar, Executive Director of Media at FS Sustainability. We are recording on Gadigal land and we pay our respects to the traditional custodians of country and elders past and present. Joining us today is Dr. Erin Coe Sutherland, Chief Sustainability Officer at Yara, a fund manager with more than $20 billion in assets under management, and a host of managed funds across equities and fixed income. Erin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle. I'm really excited to be here.
For those who are not familiar with Yara and your background, can you tell us a little bit more about the work that you do and where you were before Yara as well?
Yeah, sure. So prior to joining Yara, I was working in impact investment. So my background, I started out in environmental science many years ago and ended up coming to finance as a lever to try and affect change. So that's looked like kind of an intersection between finance, research, policy, and science over a long period of time. Prior to joining Yara, what I saw in impact investing was a trend towards advocacy and acknowledging that some of the impact strategies, which is really about trying to create deliberate, positive, measurable change alongside financial returns, was moving towards this idea that the problems and the allocations towards impact investing were a bit smaller than the scale of the problems that we were seeing. So moving to this side of the market and working with the team at Yara was the opportunity to really address some of those stewardship and engagement opportunities and some of the bigger companies. So when I landed at Yara a couple of years ago, so the team here, as you mentioned, focuses on equities and fixed income. I sit across the different investment teams as well as on the operational side. So supporting those teams on ESG integration and responsible investment, helping them with their responsible investment policies and position statements, their ESG tools and processes. Whereas the diffuse nature of the way we approach it means that every analyst and every investment team has the responsibility for the implementation of ESG and responsible investment.
What is the new climate reality?
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. What we see at Yara Capital and the reason that we wrote this paper is while we've been focused on net zero and the just transition and decarbonization, and I think that's been the right focus, we also want to acknowledge that the data is telling us that that 1.5 degree aspiration aligned to net zero is really escaping us. Where we can see data from the World Meteorological Association telling us we've already surpassed that 1.5 degrees and we may be on a well over 2 degree trajectory. When we look at historical emissions from 1990 to today, on a global level, we've only seen 5 periods of negative emissions growth, and those have been driven largely through acute events like COVID or the global financial crisis. So it is really difficult to reconcile this idea that we are unlikely to hit those net zero targets. And while I think we need to remain focused on playing a responsible role in advocating for net zero and decarbonization, we also need to take a pragmatic approach to understanding the world is getting warmer.
Yes, so we now are facing this increasingly warming world. And also extreme weather as well is a big issue, especially for those of us who live along the East Coast. Now, talking about investment portfolios again, so what does this mean for us that the new climate reality is that we are looking at around the 2 degrees Celsius?
Yeah, I think what this is telling us is that a lot of the physical risk assessments that many of us have been thinking about as more theoretical to date are becoming quite real. They're really impacting businesses in terms of asset values, insurability, operational continuity, cash flows. So, you know, I think that the climate reality is starting to become more tangible and more present and more real. As we started to look at some of the historical data to try to understand the implications on share price and for investors of some of these acute physical events, your fires, your floods, your storms, What we saw is that the historical data shows that fires are by far the most detrimental mm-hmm. event. So as you might imagine, if you're a land-based company, and we have an example in our paper of kangaroo plantation timber, and a bushfire comes through there and destroys the entire asset value of your company, that's not going to bode well for your future. So understanding how companies are exposed to these physical events, how they're mitigating those risks, how we think about the future impacts for those companies and are engaging with them to understand how they're responding to those risks has become a central part of our thesis in trying to understand what we should be doing.
Yes, you mentioned fire and you mentioned land-based operations and businesses. Can we expand further on which sectors are at risk here?
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, we've done both a top-down and a bottom-up analysis. And so going through all of our investment teams, we said on a company-by-company level and asking our analysts who cover different sectors how to elevate which sectors would be at risk. And then we used some third-party data providers and a variety of them to look at their physical risk assessment scores and methodologies. And what we can see is that pretty much every sector is at risk, and there are different types of risks. Some of the specific ones that we looked at were, you often hear about insurance and the issue there. You know, there's a number of issues there. But as we look at a company like Suncorp, and the data point we honed in on was, they had a catastrophe expense allowance. And over the last 9 years leading up to 2023, they had exceeded that allowance 7 of those 9 times. Certainly, we've seen examples with the California wildfires and the impacts that's had on some of the insurance companies there. And I know there's widespread issues around, uninsurability. I think you had a guest on some weeks back, Nikki Hartley, I believe it was. And the statistic yes. that I thought was quite shocking was the 1 in 23 properties today in Australia are currently uninsurable. I thought that's problematic on many fronts. So, we certainly looked at insurance. We looked at energy utilities. We looked at food and agriculture exposed businesses. We looked at property, construction, transport. So we looked across sectors. And what we can see is on multiple fronts, pretty much every sector is exposed in one way or another directly, but also indirectly, which the data is less good around this picture. But we know that there are worker disruptions, there are disruptions in supply chains, there are disruptions in logistics and transport when these physical events happen. And I think in some cases, we'll start to see the data coming through that those could be more severe or more impactful than just a singular asset and the damage that might come through from a storm or a flood, for example.
I know. I mean, it is a bit scary to say, well, 99.99% of the economy will be impacted by this. Can you give us an idea of how truly has this affected Yara as a whole? Did you have to recalibrate at the start of the year to say all our assumptions have to be cleared up and we need to start all over again?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think the answer is we partly have recalibrated our approach. So one of the things that drove us to this was we decided to become an early adopter of the AASB or the ISSB, all the acronyms mm-hmm. here around the mandated climate-related financial disclosures. Yes. So we're a Group 3 reporter, which means we would have to disclose our climate data in 2028, but we chose to do that quite early. So we've already put out our first climate disclosures aligned to those standards. And that helped us really create a baseline understanding and spark a discussion. Because those disclosures ground you in two different realities. And one is running a climate scenario of net zero to really understand and quantify your transition risk. And the other one is to look at a current policies or a hothouse kind of scenario, which really exacerbates the physical risk side. And when you stop and reflect on what those two different outer bounds are telling you, is neither of those is very realistic. So it forced the conversation, or it sparked the conversation, I should say, that when we actually start to look at our potential carbon liability and setting our emissions reduction targets and our climate strategy, which we've been working on for the last couple of years, what is our actual view about what is pragmatically and realistically happening? And then how does that translate down into how we think about portfolio level implications, which sparked a lot of this research where we started to do sector by sector and company by company, understanding the potential risks that those companies are facing, trying to get a better and clearer picture of the mitigation strategies and the adaptation strategies these companies are adopting, and trying to understand, are there opportunities or gaps to engage with those companies? Have the risks been fully priced in? And certainly as we do our ESG integration, we've seen more focus on certain companies around the physical risk component and unpacking that in more detail than we previously had.
And so what does that look like in practical terms? Do you find that a lot of these companies have already answered, or do they share the same concerns? Or is it quite mixed, where some are more advanced than others in trying to get a handle on this issue?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it is a bit of a mixed bag, but partly because the disclosures around decarbonization and transition risk have been more under focus. There's been greater pressure for companies to disclose their climate pathways towards net zero. So we see better disclosures and more visibility on what companies are planning to do on that front. Whereas on the physical risk side, I think a combination of factors has meant that we aren't seeing the same level of disclosures. And so it requires a lot more direct engagement with companies to get a clearer picture on that front. And one of the drivers for that lagging approach, I think, is the lack of quality data. Mm. So a lot of companies and insurance companies are probably more advanced than most. And the way that they would think about physical risk is they most likely would use different data sets to map companies' key assets and the location of those assets. They would then apply a weather predictive kind of model, looking at some of the acute events that would cause damage, and then a damage assessment model on top of that, and try and predict where the physical risk sits and how that might relate to the insurability or risk for that particular company. As you can imagine, that's not the, you know, one, there's high unpredictability around what's actually going to happen going forward. So we can guess, but we don't actually know. And the other thing is that's not the complete picture. So for every company, there's mixed data, there's mixed understanding, but we are seeing a real evolution of what companies are doing to look at it. We have some portfolio companies that we've been engaging with, like Cobram Estate. And you know, we know that they've been investing in frost fans, for example, spending a significant amount of money. And we've looked at Bega Cheese, for example, and they're investing in water-saving technologies and really reevaluating their crop strategy and trying to plan for variability in weather conditions, including heat and rainfall going forward. So we are seeing many companies and sectors thinking about these issues, but it is mixed.
Conversely, I mean, you've talked about some of the developments there and companies taking advantage of new technologies to try and manage their kind of water usage. You talked about Bega Cheese, for example. But I know that in the white paper, you also mentioned new insurance lines, the use of drones, investment in catastrophe modeling. Can you give our listeners a bit of an idea of where are the opportunities, like the really exciting opportunities in this space?
Yeah, there are a number of opportunities, and this is where we want to understand how companies are positioning themselves and where the risks and opportunities sit. So for, you mentioned insurance companies, one of the product innovation things we were seeing is insurance companies after the California bushfires creating new products that offer premium and deductible discounts in relation to sustainable land management or forestry management practices. It makes a lot of sense that if you're in a higher risk to, you know, forest fires and you're more sustainably managing that land to mitigate or reduce those, you know, catastrophic burns, mm-hmm. that you should have discounts to your premiums and your deductibles. And we're seeing that kind of product innovation. But we're seeing product innovation across all sectors. I think one of the other examples we mentioned is, you know, you're seeing food companies turn to meat alternative products. We've been seeing that for quite some time. And some of them reference quite explicitly being driven by some of the climate impacts has created these new opportunities. And I think we don't have to look too far from home. Some of the floods we've seen just in this last year,
yes.
and in the last couple of days,
yeah.
really in New South Wales mm-hmm. and in Queensland, and the impacts that's going to have and has had on livestock. And then how does that pass through to supply? How does that pass through to consumer pricing? So I think the opportunity to innovate around where does the gap sort of sit and what can companies be doing. I think there's a lot of opportunity in product innovation. Some of the other opportunities, I think, sit in resilient infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So that cross-cuts many or most industries. And, you know, some of the different aspects of that are how companies are using climate scenarios and environmental data to help them with their site selection, how they're using design principles. We mentioned some of the property companies using, you know, water-sensitive urban design to manage the land more sustainably, or doing more fire-retardant, you know, kind of landscaping or energy efficiency kind of design principles. The use of advanced materials, I think, is really exciting. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing companies like Dulux innovate around, you know, heat and fire resistant kind of products, but there's lots of advanced polymers kind of coming out, and we're looking at how do you increase the durability of buildings and infrastructure? How are you creating more opportunities for stormwater management through, you know, pervious pavement? How do you create less corrosive materials, more water and flood resistant kind of materials, fire resistant materials. And then the last category, I would say, in resilient infrastructure is around, you know, your response systems and your backup systems, and getting smarter and smarter tech around detecting the issue and responding more quickly. And I just want to mention in that category, one of the coolest things I heard recently in terms of resilient infrastructure was in Vietnam and the Netherlands. They're designing amphibious houses. So houses that are meant to sit on the land, but then adapt in flooding conditions to then float or have aspects where they become a bit amphibious for a temporary period. And I think that's a really cool design innovation and, you know, climate adaptation in practice.
Oh, yes. I want one of those. We can certainly, it'll come in handy. And I know there's been a lot of, you know, architectural designs around amphibious housing. But it'd be interesting to see it now, where the reality of extreme weather, floods, fires, and all of that is more confronting and definitely financially devastating for not just the companies themselves, but the communities. It would be silly of me to ask you, so what do you think would be the impact on this on returns? Are we talking about 2% less, 5% less? Because no one can predict that. But do you have any insights at all that we can share with our listeners on what is the reality here now that we are in the post, you know, 2 degrees Celsius world? Are we looking at, you know, extreme outliers of performances, or is the investment community really putting their heads together to say, hey guys, we want performance and returns to be stable. We don't want to shock our investors right now.
Yeah, I think that our fiduciary responsibility is always to be understanding the risks and making sure we're pricing in those risks appropriately. I think we also have a role to play in the broader economy, as you were talking about, the impacts on communities and on people, and as investors and providers of capital to help companies steward their way through some of these really complex issues that are affecting all of us. So we have that responsibility and certainly opportunity to advocate for improved approaches and to capture these kinds of opportunities. In terms of quantifying the risk and opportunity side, you know, I think there's data points that will tell you that in adaptation and resilience, you know, there's multi-trillions of dollars of opportunities. And as you start to unpack where those opportunities sit, you know, in infrastructure hardening and, you know, mitigation and asset resilience and water systems, water infrastructure. There's so many different categories, advanced materials, where, you know, it makes a lot of sense that there are going to be a lot of investment opportunities. And I think the differentiation within sectors of those companies that are understanding these risks and opportunities and positioning themselves appropriately is where we want to be positioning ourselves.
You had me at trillions of dollars. To be honest, and it is true. Erin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Michelle. And I guess I just want to leave your listeners with, you know, while the data and the research is telling us that we want to think about these risks and opportunities, I do think as investors, there is an opportunity to be reaching out to our companies, to be understanding how they're thinking about physical risk, how they're managing this for not just, you know, their investors, but also for their communities, their employees, and, you know, our society.
And as one person that I've interviewed in the past has said, I'm doing this for my 7-year-old daughter, who asked me, what are you doing about climate change, Dad? And that was a life-changing moment for him.
I think it's such a good point to end on. I myself have 4 children between the ages of 2 and 14. So I can have a climate conversation with my engaged 14-year-old when she wants to talk to me. Whereas my 2-year-old's not quite there yet. But it is, I think, it becomes more personal, and we can get out of the theoretical and technical language and make it about a very human kind of approach and ambition.
Absolutely. You're probably one of the few people who can say, well, I'm glad you asked. Here's a white paper that I prepared earlier. Erin, once again, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. Take care.
This is The Greener Way. I'm your host, Michelle Baltazar. Thank you for listening.
The Greener Way podcast is a product of FS Sustainability. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional, legal, or tax advice. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement, and if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the FS Sustainability website, fssustainability.com.au.